tell the story that is probably most likely on the minds of those who are concerned about not only life in general, but right now in particular one life, that of Terry Schindler Schiavo. Is Terry's story, yesterday it looked like it was coming to an end, or at least it was coming to the beginning of the end. There's been some news in the story. She was supposed to, as of about 2 hours ago, have had her feeding tube removed. The parents prevailed in another motion with the judge, and she's been given a stay till 4 o'clock this afternoon. And still the story is unfolding. We'll try to stay on top of it as much as we can here on Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. To that end, here in the first half hour, we're going to be hearing some audio. First from the attorney for Michael Schiavo, Terry's estranged husband and guardian, George Felos is his name. He's going to simply tell us what they're hoping to do to Terry today. And then we'll also hear from Senator Skip Campbell in Florida. He seems to have thrown up his hands, and he speaks euphemistically about what may lie ahead for Terry. And then Randall Terry, president of Society for Truth and Justice, formerly of what it's Operation Rescue, has a few things to say on behalf of the family, Terry's parents. And then, if time permits, we'll get to a few comments that were made in the news by Norma McCorvey of the famous Roe v. Wade case. She was Jane Roe. And her thoughts after 32 years of legalized abortion and her part in it. The Roe v. Wade case, that is. Open lines in the first 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. Our call-in numbers 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. In the second half hour of today's program, Dr. Edward Pruitt will be our guest. We'll talk about Muslim converts to Christianity. He is from Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. The stories of these Muslim converts to Christianity are, many of them, about a dozen of them, are chronicled in a book that he has co-authored with one of the Kaner brothers. Ergun Kaner is often on the program. His brother, Amir Fethi Kaner, also tossed in his two cents on this book called The Costly Call, Modern Day Stories of Muslims Who Found Jesus. We're going to be talking about how tough it is for a Muslim to be converted to Christianity. Not to be converted so much, but what it is like for them when they are converted to Christianity. And we'll hear some of those stories in the second half hour of Issues, Etc. today. Later in the program, there in the second hour, Pastor Will Wheaton will join us today. We'll remember second century bishop. This is a very ancient Christian. And martyr saint Polycarp, in spite of his unusual name. I mentioned this to a group of kids in a chapel this morning. They thought his name sounded funny. Nothing funny about Polycarp. Very interesting. We'll talk about that with Pastor Will Wheaton later in the program and some more open lines for your questions and your comments. Hopefully, if time also permits, we might be able to play some audio from the Canadian House of Commons, the Prime Minister, Paul Martin of Canada, standing up in favor and speaking in favor of an initiative that the House of Commons is looking at there in our neighbors to the north on what they're calling same-sex civil marriage. Kind of an odd conglomeration of terms. We're talking about gay marriage in Canada, and we'll hear what he has to say. He actually says the Constitution, a clause of the Constitution, the Canadian Constitution, pretty much requires there to be gay marriage. And in fact, he makes the case that to deny gay marriage in Canada by the lawmakers there would be to take away rights that gay couples already have in Canada. We'll hear him say that a little later in the program. Again, our call-in number is 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727. Now, the story at the top of everyone's mind is Terry Schindler Schiavo. Just to give you a brief, if you've been living under a rock, this is a woman who some years ago was under mysterious circumstances that the medicine has never been entirely clear to me, suffered severe brain damage. Her husband petitioned the court to become her guardian. He said that he would take care of her for the rest of her natural life. There was a lot of money put aside in a wrongful death, malpractice suit on her behalf for her care. He hasn't used a penny of it for her care. Pretty much as soon as the judgment was down, the money was in the bank, he decided to do everything he could to see to it that his wife wouldn't survive, short of pulling the plug himself. And he has been in a legal battle with just about everybody, including Terry Schindler Schiavo's parents. He wants to see her feeding tube and her hydration taken away. He's trying for the third time to get that feeding tube removed. It should have happened at 1 o'clock today. The parents prevailed upon a judge to give... They wanted an indefinite stay. They didn't get an indefinite stay. They got to stay until a little bit later this afternoon. They're trying to take his guardianship away from him, as they should. First, let's hear from George Filos. He's the attorney for husband and guardian Michael Schiavo. Filos says that his client will act to remove that feeding tube just as soon as the judge will let him.
As soon as he's legally authorized, he will discontinue the artificial life support.
As I said, this is the third time he's made this attempt. Twice he has already had the feeding tube removed. And twice the parents and others, including Florida Governor Jeb Bush, have managed through legal means to get the feeding tube put back on. Now, let's just tell you what this is about. This isn't pull out the feeding tube and someone within a couple hours passes away. Terry's condition, some people say she's in a persistent vegetative state, that is, non-responsive in any way. And others who have looked at her say, no, she is responsive. She is severely brain damaged. There's no doubt about that. But she may recognize people. She cannot communicate in any real way, but she responds. And they say, even if she were in a persistent vegetative state, that's no reason to starve and dehydrate her to death. It's a slow process, by the way. We're talking about something that may take 2 weeks to finally take a person's life. And in the course of it, it's painful. You die, in essence, of thirst. The only way she can be fed is through a... They use the term feeding tube. Don't think of a tube going down someone's throat. It's inserted through the side of your body into your stomach, directly into your digestive system, because she cannot swallow. Doctors do believe, however, and her parents earnestly believe, that if she had the proper kind of therapy, which her husband has denied her for about a dozen years, she might be taught to swallow again, so she could actually eat, kind of at the level of, say, a newborn infant or a 6 months old infant. Well, Michael Schiavo will have nothing to do with that. So what's happening with the other lawmakers in Florida? Florida Senator Skip Campbell, he said in an interview that the state is pretty much run out of options and it's time to give up.
I don't think the state can do anything. I don't think the state should do anything at this point in time. I think this is in God's hands, and all we can say is God bless Terry Schiavo and may she rest in peace.
I don't know. It sounds so nice, may she rest in peace. You usually don't say that till someone's already dead. That's what they put on tombstones. Someone should remind Senator Skip Campbell there of Florida that perhaps his job might be to, even when he thinks the cause is lost, continue to fight for the cause. And it's all fine and good to say God bless Terry Schindler Schiavo and may she rest in peace, but she's not dead yet. She's still very much alive. It sounds good, doesn't it? I wish you well. Now let's get that feeding tube out, and within 2 weeks, 3 weeks, you'll be gone. May you rest in peace. There's absolutely nothing compassionate about what the senator had to say there. Randall Terry of Operation Rescue, formerly now of the Society for Truth and Justice, has been acting as press spokesperson for Terry's parents in this case of late. Terry says that the family believes Florida's Governor Jeb Bush can still do something and may still do something.
The family is counting on Governor Bush to intervene. He did it once before, and they are praying and believing that he will do it again. He's a good man, and his heart is with Terry.
Now, what the governor did was fast-track a bill through the legislature in Florida that came to be known as Terry's Law that would have made it illegal to do what Michael Schiavo wants to do to his wife as a guardian. It was a law, admittedly, written pretty much for the situation in which Terry Schindler Schiavo finds herself. And it passed overwhelmingly. It was deemed unconstitutional by the Florida Supreme Court. So the governor has done a number of things. It was about, what, a year, maybe 2 years ago, that we were talking with people at the point where Jeb Bush could really do something about that, and we were encouraging people to write the governor. And many of our listeners wrote back to us saying, this is the letter I sent to the governor. This is what I wrote to Jeb Bush, asking him, prevailing upon him to act on behalf of Terry Schindler Schiavo. He did. I don't know what he can do now. Everyone we talked to, Rita Marker, Wesley Smith, kind of throw up their hands when it comes to what can the governor do now. And yet, Randall Terry, president of Society for Truth and Justice and spokesperson for Terry's parents, says that the family is still very hopeful.
The family is hopeful. We had a miracle the last time, and we're looking for a miracle this time. And we're basing that upon the goodwill that has been expressed in this building.
Now, there he is standing on the steps of the Florida State House. And he has, in spite of the euphemistic rhetoric of men like Senator Skip Campbell in Florida, not everyone has given up. In fact, most of the lawmakers, especially after the passage of Terry's law, have been pretty enthusiastic about trying to keep her alive. Now, here's a situation where you wonder, are they all really interested in Terry's life, or are they interested in something that, you know, it just looks bad. It just looks really bad when you've got a husband who, quite obviously, through his subsequent actions, is interested in getting at Terry's health fund, in essence, and seeing to it that his wife is out of his life as quickly as possible. We had someone call yesterday when we were talking with Rita Marker about this and simply ask, why doesn't Michael Schiavo divorce his wife? He's taken up with another woman. He's had children by another woman. Although he is still legally married to Terry Schindler Schiavo, why doesn't he simply divorce her and say, your parents can be your guardian or someone else? Or the court, please, guardian ad litem, please, because the court can appoint a guardian. A disinterested third party. And that remains a big question. Why doesn't he? If you were in Michael Schiavo's shoes, you might say, this is not worth my time. And as in so much as I want to see my wife die, it's hardly worth my time anymore. I think probably all the money that was in her health fund has already been spent on lawyers one way or the other. Why does he stay in it? Matter of principle. Rita Marker said, it's gotten to the point where I'm going to win this. He's dug in his heels, perhaps. And this led Randall Terry to make a rather chilling comparison.
Terry does not deserve to be starved to death. If we brought a dog and put it in a cage here at the Capitol and said, we're going to starve this dog to death, there would be an outrage across this community, and justly so. Well, why would we treat a human being in a way that we wouldn't treat a dog?
We should remember also that in the course of his now three attempts to have his wife starved to death, dehydrated to death, Michael Schiavo has also at the same time been refusing her what most medical professionals would consider kind of basic care. No antibiotics? She's not getting very good care because her husband, who wants her dead, is in charge of her care. It would be one thing if he said, I'll give her the best possible care. Her parents can come in and see her. But no, she's really, Rita Marker said yesterday, in solitary confinement. The health professionals can see her, but no one can get in to see her without Michael's permission. And he's not granting a lot of permission for people to get in and see Terry Schindler Schiavo. By the way, if you're interested in seeing her real situation, you can just look up her name on the web. There's a website dedicated to Terry. And you can go there, and they actually have video that you can download on your computer where you can see her responding to a light, her responding to her mother who's talking to her. It's not mind-blowing stuff, folks, but you watch it and you say, this is not a person who is completely unaware of her surroundings. You know what it looks like to me? It looks, and I made the comparison with the newborn baby, it looks a lot to me like the way my kids responded to me when they were brand new, when they were in the first months of life. They couldn't talk to me. They didn't know daddy's name. They couldn't say my name when I walked in. They might have confused me with somebody else. If any man walked in, but they responded. Their eyes were open. They looked at me. And that's about how Terry is. And it seems to me that if the infant at that stage, although they'll grow out of it, is worthy of our protection, and what parents protect their children at this point with such ferocity, and the law would protect such a child, shouldn't an adult who by happenstance of a medical accident, malfeasance, has been reverted to that state and that it's permanent, shouldn't they be protected as well? Just because she isn't what she used to be. See, with the babies, we look at them, we say, well, why do we protect them when they can barely respond to us or not feed themselves or not care for themselves, not get up and walk around? Well, we say, well, they're going to grow into so much more. This is just the start. I don't see how it's really any different for someone just because she was something in terms of her ability and her cognitive powers at one time more than she is now. She's no less a person, just like the baby is no less a person when they're at that very infantile stage of development. Now, we talked about that chilling comparison. I think that's one that ought to stick in our mind, that what Michael Schiavo was proposing for his wife is worse than anyone, any thinking, decent person would tolerate for an animal. That's what he's proposing. And he's, I guess the saddest thing is that he's proposing it be done with state sanction, or at least judicial sanction. One more comment here from Randall Terry, president of Society for Truth and Justice, on behalf of Terry's parents and Terry. He says that everyone, this really affects us all. It's not just about Terry.
It really cuts to the heart of what it means to be a civilized society. Are we going to starve our weakest, most defenseless members? And I pray to God that the answer is no. Otherwise, we're all in trouble.
What will we be doing here through the next couple of days if, in fact, 4 o'clock rolls around, now the magic point on the clock, and this temporary stay that the judge has put into place for Terry runs its course? And the courts deny the parents further petitions here. What will we be doing? All of us. Think about it. We won't stop talking about Terry Schindler Schiavo, of course. But for the next 10 days, 2 weeks, we'll be waiting for her to die. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. She's in this legal limbo right now, so the court has cleared the way for the feeding tube to be removed. But Circuit Judge George Greer, this is kind of acting counter to his character, because he's been the one, I said yesterday, notorious for kind of giving Michael Schiavo whatever he wants. Even Judge Greer at the end says, okay, the parents can have a one-day stay for yet another legal argument. When it comes to the life of a human being, people on death row get appeal after appeal after appeal. They can make use of the legal system to keep themselves alive or to try and reverse the decision of their execution pretty much as long as they want to. In some states that have the death penalty but are not want to practice it, being condemned for a capital crime and being given the death sentence means life in prison. You go sit on death row the rest of your life. You die on death row. Because you can use the legal system as long as you want. Now, Terry has committed no crimes. I don't think even Michael Schiavo would say that Terry has wronged anyone. No one's arguing that. So if someone who is guilty of a capital crime and been found guilty of a capital crime can continue to employ the legal system to try to avert their execution, or just to try and slow things down until the execution comes, for as long as they really want to, if they can appeal to a governor for clemency all the way up to the moment the needle goes in their arm, that's the way it works, all the way up until the moment the needle goes in someone's arm, they still have an appeal to the governor of the state. The governor may say yes, he may say no. If that's the case for people who are guilty of a capital crime, for someone, Terry Schindler Schiavo in particular, who is guilty of no crime, who has been not only the victim of whatever brought her down in the first place, but also of medical malpractice, and now her husband's cruel lack of concern for her. shouldn't she be allowed pretty much carte blanche to use the legal system, or those on behalf of her, to use the legal system to try and keep her alive as much as possible? What's the urgency, I ask? Whether you think that the people who are infirm should be allowed to be starved or dehydrated to death, there may be some of you out there who actually believe that. I hope that number is few. Even if you believe that's the case, I ask, what's the hurry? What's the hurry for Terry Schindler Schiavo? What's the hurry for her guardian and estranged husband, Michael Schiavo? What's the hurry for the lawyers like George Filos, who seems earnest upon helping Michael Schiavo have his wife put out of his life for good? What's the urgency? You have never seen wheels grind more slowly than when a criminal is condemned to death. And rightly so, a justly administered death penalty in any state should have the slowest turning wheels possible, because the state never undertakes that kind of punishment without not only due consideration, but overdue consideration, so that we see that justice is actually done, right? That's why we give appeals to people on death row. That's why more than the normal appeals would be allowed. That's why clemency is a possibility all the way up to the very last moment. Because we wouldn't undertake to do this kind of thing, even for a criminal, without allowing those wheels to slow them down. It may frustrate people who are innocent, but let's slow them down so that we make sure that this is done right. Some people have been pulled off of death row who didn't deserve to be there because the wheels just turn that slow. Well, I think that the wheels ought to turn just as slowly for Terry Schindler Schiavo. I don't see why Judge Greer can't allow the Schiavo parents to have more than a day. We're talking about, what time is it here? We're going on 3:30 Central Time. What's the big hurry? What's another day going to make? What's another month, year? The judge could say, look, exhaust yourselves legally. I'll still be here a year from now. Go ahead and make every argument you can make. Run to the bottom of your list. Get to the bottom of the barrel. This doesn't have to happen tomorrow. And I would say, folks, it certainly doesn't have to happen today. When we come back from this break, we're going to be talking with Edward Pruitt. He's Associate Director of the Center for Great Commission Studies and Adjunct Professor of Missions at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. He's co-author of the new book, The Costly Call, Modern Day Stories of Muslims Who Found Jesus. We're going to be talking about how difficult it is for those who have been raised in Islam and then been found by Jesus Christ and made Christians, the cross that they bear, the suffering that is particular to those who, many of them still living in Islamic nations. We'll talk about that when we come back from the break. A little bit later in the program, Pastor Will Wheaton will be our guest. We're going to be talking with him about second century bishop, martyr, saint, Polycarp. Stay tuned.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
In the Old Testament book of Joshua, God commands Joshua and the armies of Israel to completely drive out and destroy their Canaanite enemies. How can a God of love demand war and killing? You'll find an answer to this question in the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, the Concordia Commentary on Joshua. The book is $42.99 plus shipping and handling. Visit our website, issuesetc.org, for more information on the Concordia Commentary on Joshua. Or order the book by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Call any weekday during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. Ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, the Concordia Commentary on Joshua. The website address again, issuesetc.org, or 1-800-325-3040.
India is an emerging technological power, promising bright futures for the educated. But this Global Minute informs you that millions still live in poverty and despair. Spiritual darkness, malnutrition, and illiteracy fill each day with foreboding for the poor in India. It's the children who suffer most. Christians who work at the Ramabai Mukti Mission see desperate orphaned boys and girls enter the campus every day. Mukti is a haven for these children, offering hope, nourishment, and education. These children learn about Jesus' life, love, and resurrection power. Their teachers and house mothers pray regularly for them, asking God to change their destinies from despair into trust and confidence in Him. Pray more children in India will experience Christ's love. See changed lives of boys and girls in India at Mukti on a free new DVD or video. Call 1-800-268-0461. Ask for Buds and Blossoms. 1-800-268-0461.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. I think it's stupid, I said to the stranger with me in the elevator. He agreed. The door had just closed, two others having exited. They had been praising the gates, the latest controversial project of Christo. His gates, hung with orange saffron, stretch for 23 miles through Central Park. These days, beauty seems to be in the eye of the beholder. If you want, you can see the gates from the top of the Metropolitan Museum of Art on 5th Avenue at 82nd Street. Or better, you can go into the museum and see the largest collection of art in the Western Hemisphere, real, time-tested art. Beauty to behold. The Bible praises the gates of Solomon's temple as a way of praising God and his worship, and those gates preview the gates of heaven. Revelation 21 says, I saw the holy city. It had a great high wall with 12 gates. On no day will its gates ever be shut. On Broadway at 61st, a new museum opens this May. Its website says, the Museum of Biblical Art represents a new model in American museology, one that emphasizes the original functions and meanings of objects growing out of the Christian and Jewish traditions. By that time, Christo's gates will be long gone. Won't your entrance into the heavenly gates depend more upon whom you behold than your Rorschach imagination?
Mornings on AM 850 KFUO offer you a Christian way to start your weekday. Hi, I'm Paul Clayton, inviting you to hear your inspirational Christian favorites, great guests, and the information you need to prepare you for the road ahead. And after the morning show at 9:30, stick around for Focus on the Family on AM 850 KFUO.
In just a few minutes here, we're going to be talking with Dr. Edward Pruitt, and we're going to be discussing with him Muslim converts to Christianity. This is one of those things, kind of the untold story of the 21st century. The great untold story of the 21st century is modern Christian persecution. That's the great untold story. That in the 20th century, more Christians have been martyred for being Christians than in all previous centuries combined. It happened in the great pogroms of communism. It happened under Nazism. It happened in China. Still happens in places like the Sudan and other countries. Nowadays, and this is just coming to light for those of us who were really just not paying attention up to this point, it is those who have been raised in Muslim countries, perhaps even as Muslims themselves, and then been converted to Christianity. And life suddenly becomes very, very difficult for them in so many ways. And we're going to talk about some of those ways and some of those stories in the course of this half hour of Issues, etc. If you have a question or a comment, our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Edward Pruitt is Associate Director of the Center for the Great Commission for Great Commission Studies and Adjunct Professor of Missions at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. He has co-authored this new book with one of the Kaner brothers called The Costly Call, Modern Day Stories of Muslims Who Found Jesus. Dr. Pruitt, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd. I sure appreciate it. By the way, just for the record, I don't have my doctorate yet. I am working on that or working toward that through the University of South Africa, so maybe someday soon, but not as of today.
All right. Well, then, Edward, I will not award you an honorary degree in advance.
All right.
I'll let you earn it the old-fashioned way.
That's right. It's a little better that way. A little bit harder, but a little bit better.
Now, the great untold story of the 21st century can be modern Christian persecution.
Mm-hmm.
What makes the persecution suffered by Muslim converts to Christianity different than, say, all the other persecution that Christians have suffered under communism and Nazism and things like that?
I'm not sure exactly how to answer that as to how it's different, because it seems like every generation of Christianity has faced some type of persecution in some part of the world. But the people in the book are personal friends of mine I've gotten to know over the last 8 years, and it seems like from them the thing that makes it more heinous is the fact that it comes from their own personal families. You know, in some places, when you convert from some other religion to Christianity, it's the outside world that oppresses you or persecutes you. But when it's your own personal family, when your mother or your father tries to kill you because you've turned your back on Islam and put your faith and trust in Christ, it seems to be just a little more heinous because it's your mom or dad that's trying to kill you.
Why is that? What is it about Islam, especially vis-a-vis Christianity and those who convert, that put people in such danger from their own loved ones?
Well, there's a misconception out there that in Islamic countries where Islamic law is the law of choice, that there's still religious freedom. But I've talked with several imams, and to them, religious freedom is the right to become Muslim. And in the hadith itself, it says, well, for example, hadith 957, in verses 50 through 56, it says, and I'm paraphrasing this, but it's an accurate paraphrase, if a Muslim changes his Islamic religion, kill him. I mean, that's what it says. So when a hadith, which is the second most revered book in all of Islam, because the Quran is first, when a hadith tells you if a man converts, you kill him, or a woman. When a Muslim converts, you kill him. It depends on how strict a country or a group or a society adheres to the hadith.
Now, is this true of, I guess we could call it, Western Islam, the westernized Islam that tends to be, I guess I would call it more moderate or liberal Islam that we see in the United States?
No. The further west you go and the further you get out of Islamic countries where Islamic law is the rule, they become more westernized. Just to give you an example, in Istanbul, in Turkey, when you're in Istanbul, you almost forget that you're in an Islamic society, because the women, they don't dress in the typical Islamic dress. They'll wear tight jeans. You would think Britney Spears is their fashion guru, because they're wearing tight jeans. They're showing their midriff. They've got lots of makeup on. Now, the further you get from Istanbul, where the West hasn't quite penetrated as much, you get into Çanakkale and further outside of Istanbul, you find the women wearing the traditional dress. So I think the Western influence, political and cultural, has had such an impact on the Muslim society that they integrate into that society as much as possible. Now, the problem is this. If they truly believe the hadith, then their belief system would say if a Muslim converts, you would kill him. But it wouldn't be I don't think you'll find an imam in America that would say, yeah, if a Muslim converts, kill him. But yet he won't go against the hadith. He's between a rock and a hard place, because culture says you can't do that. But the hadith, which he can't go against, says you should do it. So I think the Muslims in the West, some of them have become more cultural acceptance of Christianity, so they wouldn't turn their back on a Muslim who converted. But the more faithful they are to Islam, or the more radical they are about Islam, then they would hold to the more traditional Hadith teachings.
So for a Muslim, at least according to the Hadith and Sharia law,
mm-hmm.
and things that are drawn from the Quran, for a Muslim to convert from Islam to Christianity is, at the very least, to be ostracized, at the very most, to be the object of someone's ill will, perhaps even a death threat.
Right, and ridicule. They're ridiculed. They're seen as infidels. You know, according to the Quran, we all are born innocent and born Muslim. And that's one of the reasons that I've never found a Muslim yet that would say, okay, if you're born a Muslim and you observed Islamic teachings, you can't truly convert. They'll say you revert. You've reverted to Christianity, or you reverted to some other religion. They won't say you converted. But in the book, these 20 stories, which the first 19 stories is 15 men and 4 women from 18 different countries, they have truly converted, and it's seen by their lifestyle. When you see what they had to go through, the persecution they had to suffer, and you see the impact that God is using them to make on society, the stand they're making, you can see it's a true conversion. So most Muslims will say, no, you don't convert, but once a Muslim does convert, he realizes that he has truly converted.
Tell us one of those stories. Which of them stands out for you as perhaps typical or most telling of the stories that are found in the book, Costly Call?
I'll try to give you just a couple snippets of a couple different ones. And the reason being, over the last 8 years, these are men and women that I have met, become good friends with, and I've seen the impact on their lives. With one of them, a dear friend of mine in Malaysia, his father, who had become a Christian, and he didn't know it. He hadn't told anybody except his wife. So the son, who is my friend, as a young man, didn't know his father was a Christian until the police burst in his house one day and came out. They were having breakfast and came out and arrested his father. And this individual, who I'm writing about, didn't realize that he had his father's blood all over him until he went into the house. But what has happened, they beat the father with clubs. Long and short of, they eventually killed the father about 4 years later. They took his home away from him. They took all his finances away. And he was trying to escape the country with his son, trying to get him out of the country because of all the persecution. The father and mother turned their back. All of society turned their back on this family. And his father was shot and killed. And I was just with him this past month. I was in he's not in Malaysia anymore. But I was with him in his country of residence, and I was asking him how things are now. He says, you know, Ed, God has delivered me from all the nightmares and from all the horror. And he says, I'm at peace with everything. He said, there's only one thing. And he starts looking at his hand. He starts rubbing his fingertips. He said, you know, when my dad left me, when he was shot and he fell into the water, he said, I was holding his hand. And he said, I still feel his touch. And so this is the kind of things they had to endure. The first person that I met in 1998 that I become dear friends with from Bangladesh, the title is called The Marks on His Back. And the reason for that, we were in the same hotel, and I saw him going down to we were a bunch of us in a hotel, and we're going room to room talking and fellowshipping, and I saw him coming out of his room, going to another room, and he had a T-shirt on. You know, it's more like a bodybuilder shirt, so you can see your shoulders. And I noticed that he had these huge welts on his back, on his left side, on his right side, on his shoulders. And so I asked him, I said, how did you get those? And with tears in his eyes, he starts to tell me the story of how he actually, in Bangladesh, was a political leader. And when they found out that he was a Christian, he had to denounce Jesus or lose his job. He said, I can't denounce the one who died for me. And he refused to denounce Jesus. So they fired him, and they took his car away from him immediately because he was provided a car. And he had to catch the bus home. Well, when he got off at the bus stop at his house, or close to his house, the police were there. They arrested him, and he was in jail for several years. Well, every 6 months, they gave him a chance to renounce Jesus, and he wouldn't do it. And when they wouldn't, he said they would separate their fingers and put three chains on each hand between the fingers so that it separated them, so that each chain made a mark on his back. So with three chains on the left side of his shoulders and three on the right shoulder, they would hit him different times, sometimes 10 times, sometimes 20 times each, trying to get him to denounce Christ. And I've touched his back, and this is the kind of thing that they've endured. So it's pretty severe persecution.
Now, you have mentioned several times here in both of these stories the police coming.
Yeah.
It sounds as though this isn't just my family has turned their back on me, or my father has denounced me, or I'm shunned in society when I go to the market. It sounds as though the mechanism of the state in some of these largely Muslim nations comes into play here, too.
If they have adopted the Islamic law as the law of the land, for example, Pakistan in 1986 adopted Islamic law as the law of Pakistan. So, for example, in Pakistani law, section 295C is a section that talks about blasphemy. It says, if you by statement or innuendo say anything against Muhammad or Islam, then you can be sentenced to prison or death. So, and it depends on the judge. When you go before the judge in Pakistan, and he hears your crime, you know, you could say something like, well, you know, I think Muhammad was crazy. And if you were to do that, the judge would decide whether or not that was worthy of prison or is it worthy of death. And it's up to that judge, but Pakistani law allows you to be killed, and they do kill people occasionally in Pakistan, as they do in other places. Malaysia, 2002, it's an Islamic Republic, Sharia law. They've adopted the teaching of the Hadith, and what it says becomes their law. And the judges of the land interpret that law in the context of the Hadith and decide, okay, you go to prison, you die.
Why is it that we don't hear, with all of the emphasis, and rightly so, on extending human rights into all corners of the earth, why is it that these instances of religious freedom, we hear about Falun Gong in China, mm-hmm. we don't hear about this, very, very little news about this kind of organized, institutionalized denial of religious freedom?
I don't honestly know why we don't hear about it. I would assume that part of it is it's, there are things that's politically correct to talk about and things that are not politically correct. And Islam is such a large, large religion around the world. And depends on who you talk to. Some people say it's the fastest growing religion in the world, and it very well could be. You know, when you see statistics, statistics can be skewed, depends on who takes the statistics. But I've seen statistics that do say Islam is the fastest growing religion in the world. And with the pressure that the Islamic community is putting on, let me rephrase that, the radical, fundamental Islamic community is putting on the rest of Islam, a lot of people want to stay away from anything controversial to do with Islam. With that in mind, I want to be sure and say this. You know, the 9/11 issue and the terrorism and all that, I hope that the American public doesn't think that every Muslim is a part of that, because they're not. I meet Muslims all over the world, and I would say, by and large, the average Muslim that I meet, they don't know about Hadith 957. They haven't read the Hadith. They don't know about jihad. They don't know about these things, and they're just trying to live their life as faithful to Allah as they can. And so what I try to do is share with them about Christ, and it's amazing the change in attitude that they have. So I want to be sure that the American public knows that not every Muslim is their enemy. Not every Muslim is out to get Christians. Although Muslim teaching does say that, you know, that they should kill Christians. You know, the only true religion in the world, according to the Hadith and, of course, the Quran, is Islam, and the rest of us are infidels. But the average Muslim that I meet doesn't adhere to that, but there are those fundamentalists that do.
We're talking about Muslim converts to Christianity during this last 25 minutes of the first hour of Issues Etc. today. I'm Todd Wilkin. Edward Pruitt is our guest. Ed is Associate Director of the Center for Great Commission Studies and Adjunct Professor of Missions at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, and he's co-authored a new book called The Costly Call, Modern Day Stories of Muslims Who Found Jesus. Has it always been this way in the Muslim world? If depending on what historian you listen to, if you go back to earlier history where Muslim nations existed, say in the Middle East, there seemed to have been more tolerance, or at least people will talk about there being more tolerance for Christianity and for Christians.
I don't know that there has been more tolerance. I think what has happened is in our world today, communication is so rapid, and if something happens today, CNN or BBC or someone broadcast it. I think that as events start to unfold, we are aware of the things that happen more readily today than we were, you know, 100 years ago, 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago. So I think there's always been the radical fundamental Muslims who hold very, very strictly to the Quran and to the Hadith. And so in their mind, when Muslims change from their religion to anything else, their attitude is let's kill them. By the same token, they don't want to become infected with any other religion. So the only way you can stop that is to kill those who adhere to another religion. You know, that's not to say that everything that's been done in the name of Christianity has been done right either. There's been a lot of things done in the name of Christianity that Christ would definitely not approve of. But I think there's always throughout history, I think you can go back and find times where we see the places of persecution and we see the places where Christians were killed in the name of Allah or in the name of Muhammad. But I think today, because information is more readily available, I think we just know about it more.
You have an appendix to the book titled Christian Persecution in Muslim Nations, and it's broken down into regions of the globe.
Right.
Including the Middle East, North Africa, other places as well.
Mm-hmm.
If you could put your finger on the globe to say, this is where it's worst for a Muslim who is converted to Christianity. This is where it's, you don't want to be the Muslim who is converted to Christianity. Where would your finger fall on the globe?
I would have to say probably three countries. I think that Egypt, Iraq, and probably, maybe four, Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, those four would definitely be the top four, and right behind it would be Malaysia. I think the most friendly would be Jordan. And I base that on I've been to Jordan twice, and I've got friends there. And in Jordan, the official law is if you're Christian, then you're born into Christianity, because they think you're born into Christianity just like you're born into Muslim. If you're born into a Christian family, then it's okay to be a Christian. But if you're born into a Muslim, they still do not want you to convert. But I don't know if anyone in Jordan has been killed for doing that. So I think they interpret the law a little looser. They're a little more Christian-friendly in Jordan than they are any of the other Islamic countries. So Jordan would definitely be the most Christian-friendly, and probably Egypt, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, those three would probably be the most anti-Christian, and the ones who, if you converted to Christianity, you would want to get out of country as soon as possible.
And what would it be like in that handful of countries that you mentioned being the hot spots? What would it be like for someone who is a Christian, that is, not a former Muslim, but a Christian?
Well, the Islamic community would consider a hadith, and they would consider you worthy of death. For example, I have a friend that is an Egyptian. Now, I did not write about him in the book because he has written his own book several years ago, so I didn't want to include him in this work. But his own family tried to get him to come back home. He escaped with his life. He used to take the newspaper when he would go get fish at the market, and they would wrap it up with newspaper, and sometimes the papers would have something about Christianity. He would save those newspapers and read about Christianity through the newspaper because he was a Christian. Well, his family found out that he was a Christian. They sentenced him to death. And so he escaped. He was from Cairo, went up to Alexandria, and tried to work things out with his parents. But his parents said, "We don't have a son. Our son has died." And he finally escaped and is here in the States now. And they've tried several times to get him to come home to kill him by saying, "Your mother's real sick. She's now wanting to see you before she dies. Please come home." And so he would find out from friends who are still there that, no, she's fine. And so he's trying to figure out, why in the world is my sister and why is my family trying to tell me to come home, only to find out that at the airport he would be arrested, and he's already been sentenced to death. So if he ever steps foot back in Egypt, he will die.
One of the places on the globe there that I found of interest is the former Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
People think Muslim nations, they think Saudi Arabia. They
right.
think the Sudan. They think Arab or African nations, maybe Indonesia if you're in the know, but not the former Soviet Union. Tell us very briefly about that.
Well, it depends on which country you're talking about from the former Soviet Union. Let me just speak, for example, to Kyrgyzstan. Now, please understand, I'm against communism. I believe that the American way is the best way. I really do. I think democracy is the way to go. But communism did one thing positive from a religious perspective, and that is, in Kyrgyzstan especially, it tore down the religious belief system of Islam, because everyone, in order to hold office, had to say they were an atheist. So, for example, the people in Kyrgyzstan are not nearly as faithful to go to the mosque. If they go to the mosque, they only go to the mosque maybe for the Friday noon prayer. For example, there's a city called Gulcha. It's up at the border with Kazakhstan, and the mosque is closed. And this was in 2000. When I was there in 2000, the mosque was closed. They don't even open it up. And the reason being is, nope, now there's an imam there. And he's the only, if you can call him faithful, he doesn't even go open the mosque up. But he's the only faithful believer. Nobody goes to the mosque. So what communism did was it tore down the belief structure, and which makes it easier for Christians to go in. So I know in Kyrgyzstan it's a cultural Islam. It's kind of like in America there's a certain thing called cultural Christianity.
Sure.
They really don't live by the teachings of the Bible. They probably don't go to church more than Christmas and Easter. but they want to call themselves Christian. They don't really know what the Bible says, but they want to be a Christian. In Kyrgyzstan and some of the former Soviet republics, that's more of the kind of Islam you're going to find. You don't find quite as much radical Islam. Now, there are pockets of radical Islam, even within those Soviet republics, but it's not nearly to the extent it would be in North Africa, Middle East.
Then finally, with only about a minute and a half here, You have mentioned several times that many of these Muslim converts to Christianity at least spent some time as, I guess you could call them, what, secret Christians?
Right.
Talk about them for just a moment.
Well, for you or I, when we become a Christian, we go and we get baptized, and there's no real issue for us to face. But for them, when they become a believer, it is a secret believer until they have the faith to step out and say, okay, I want to be baptized. For a Muslim to become baptized is a humongous step for them. And then for it to go public, because they are facing such persecution, normally their intimate family, they tell their wife first, and then they'll tell, if the parents are still alive, they'll tell the parents. And if they don't get too bad a reaction from that inner circle, then they'll start to tell other family members. And they'll start to branch out, and then they'll start to tell those that they work with. And when they get to a place where they start to face radical persecution, that's where they start to seek asylum somewhere. But normally, because they do face such radical persecution, and so many of them have died, it's just like in Indonesia in March of 1998, a lot of people think that all that went on was between the Javanese and the Chinese.
We've only got about 20 seconds here, Ed.
But really, if you talk to the Chinese that are there, most of them that were oppressed and beaten and killed were Christians. And so they will tell you it's an Islam-Christian issue, not a cultural issue.
Edward Pruitt is Associate Director of the Center for Great Commission Studies and Adjunct Professor of Missions at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. He's co-authored this new book called The Costly Call, Modern-Day Stories of Muslims Who Found Jesus. We've been talking about Muslim converts to Christianity. Edward, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you. I sure appreciate it.
When we come back from this break, we've got open lines for your questions and your comments. Some audio that we didn't get to there in the first 25 minutes. I'd like to get to some of that. Norma McCorvey, of course, famous through her pseudonym, Jane Roe. That will ring a bell with you 32 years ago. We'll hear from her just a little bit. And we've got some audio from the Prime Minister of Canada, Paul Martin, who is speaking to the House of Commons there in favor of Canada's gay marriage, gay civil unions. I'm not sure what they're calling it, Bill. When we come back, stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.